excited about eating from the forbidden fruit. Let me just read the first couple of verses there. If you have your Bibles, you can open to Genesis 3. I'm going to read from verse 1. It says, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, 'Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?'" He was trying to find out what objection she might have from what he was selling. And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat fruit from the tree in the garden, but God did say you must not eat from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it or you will die." You know something that she added there that God never said? Because if you read closely in terms of the instructions that God gave to Adam, we're never told that he gave the same instruction to Eve. Maybe Adam had to pass it on. Maybe Adam messed the whole thing up. Ladies, I'm giving you that out, possibly. But there was never any mention that we couldn't touch the fruit, that they were forbidden to touch it. They were just not to eat it. The serpent, being crafty, goes, "Ah, chink in the armor here. You will not die," the serpent said to the woman, "for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." In sales, he gives her the features, the advantages, and the benefits. And she begins to take a look at it. And it said, "When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took and ate it, and she gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it." Did you notice that, ladies? Did you notice that, guys? He gave some to her husband who was with her. Oftentimes we read that passage and we think it was only Eve and the serpent. Adam was there, the strong, silent type, the entire time. Didn't say anything. I think Adam was sitting there going, "Okay, let's see. I'm going to do my first biology experiment. What will happen to Eve if she eats that?" Nothing happens to Eve. And so then she gave some to Adam who was with her, and he ate. Eugene Peterson, as it says in your notes, the way that Eugene Peterson translates that, "When the woman saw that the tree was looked like good eating and realized what she would get out of it, she'd know everything. She took and ate the fruit and gave her some to her husband, and he ate." The first sale was right there, and the birth of materialism was off and running. Now, I want you to think in terms of a car salesman for a second. I sold cars for a number of years. I went in, I was trained in the industry. Within 15 months, I became the corporate training director. And I went on the fast track and became a sales manager. But I'll never forget when I was first selling cars, when my boss came to me and said, "Roger, this salesperson out there is having a problem. What I need you to do is I need you to go get the guy to drive the car and get all ethered up." Have you ever heard that phrase? You got to get him under the ether. And I had no idea what he meant. And so later on, I went to examine what ether does. You know what? Ether was one of the first primitive anesthesias. They would use ether to knock you out so they could operate on you. And this is what salespeople will say: if they can get you ethered, they can operate on you. Instead of removing your gallbladder or removing your spleen or removing your tonsils, they will remove your wallet and 60 months of payments. That's what they might remove. And so ether, as you begin to take the first whiff of ether, and if you look at the chemical compound of ether, it's exactly the same as alcohol minus the H2O. You take a whiff of the ether, and the first thing, your mind begins to feel giddy, woozy, buzzed. Another whiff, and you'll feel euphoria. And then you'll begin to lose control of your voluntary motor skills. You will not be able to touch your hand to your nose. You will not be able to walk a straight line. You will not be able to recite the alphabet backwards. Another whiff of ether, and you will lose your involuntary motor skills. And then the fourth stage of being etherized or under the ether is that you become unconscious. And this all is happening as the car salesman has you out by the car. I'm giving away. I hope there's not a car salesman in here that you're going to be really mad at me at the end of this. But this is what happens, is that they get you touching the car. They begin to imagine that car in your driveway. They begin to have you sit and touch the leather seats, the leather-wrapped steering wheel. If it's cold, they have you turn on the heated seats. If it's hot, they have you turn on the air conditioning. Then they have you listen to the stereo system. You begin to imagine. And then they have you take a whiff, not of ether, but of the new car smell. And then you say to them, as you're beginning to feel woozy and you're losing motor skill control, they say to you, what would you imagine would work? And you say something like, well, I don't want to pay any more than $1,000 down. I want $10,000 for my 85 Yugo in trade, and no more than $350 a month on this $40,000 vehicle. And they said, sounds like it'll work to me, because you are kind of staggering. And they take you in, and as you're walking out of finance, you've kept your Yugo. You have no idea how you're taking it home with you. You've written a check for $7,500. You're writing a check for $650 a month for the next 72 months, and you've left your firstborn behind at the dealership, but you're driving home with the car. Now, when you're coming out of the ether and on the operation, what happens is that you begin to feel woozy again, but it's not a good woozy. You no longer feel euphoric. You begin to come out of it in the recovery room, and you begin to feel queasy, and you begin to feel sick, and then you get a hangover. In the sale, it's called buyer's remorse. And you wake up in the morning, and you look out, and you say, how did I end up with this car and this payment for the next 72 months? Because you are under the influence of the ether. And that's how materialism works. We end up buying things that we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't even like. Now say it again with me. I can never get enough of what I really don't need. So, to borrow a line from Jeff Foxworthy, you may be a materialist if you believe. Look on your outline. You may be a materialist if you believe that I am what I drive. If you believe that you are what you drive, that that's all about image, you may be a materialist. Or you may be a materialist if you believe I am what I earn. I am what I earn. I got a great example of that, a sign that I read about. The sign said this: when I first started working, I used to dream of the day I would earn the salary that I'm now starving on. I used to dream of the day that I would earn the salary that I'm now starving on. You may be a materialist if you believe that I am what I have. How much is enough? How much is really enough? You know what? It doesn't matter. The answer is always the same. It doesn't matter if you make $10,000 a year, $100,000 a year, or $1 million a year, the answer to that question is always the same. How much is enough? A little more than what I have right now. Repeat with me again. I can never get enough of what I really don't need. You may be a materialist if I am what I wear. How much is that little guy riding the horse playing polo really worth? How much extra money do we spend for the emblem? It's the same material, but we'll spend an extra $25, $35, $45 for a certain brand. You may be a materialist if you say or believe I am what I spend. How much do we spend? National average for Americans. Americans spend on the average $1.21 or $1.22 for every dollar they earn, but not in the Bay Area. In the Bay Area, we spend on the average $1.41 for every dollar that we earn, which means when your boss says, hey, congratulations, I'm giving you a $10,000 raise this year, say, I can't afford it. Because if I take the raise, that means I'm going to spend $14,000. I'm going to go $4,000 behind. I can't afford that raise. Or finally, you may be a materialist if you believe I am where I live or I am what I live in. Imagine this. You have a home that's valued at $350,000 and you sell it. And you buy another home for $700,000. Will that make you twice as happy? May make you twice as stressed out, but not maybe twice as happy. And when you add all of this up, the bottom line is my net worth equals my self-worth. When we begin to say who I really am is what I earn, what I drive, what I have, what I wear, what I spend, where I live, or what I live in, if that's where we come, then our net worth has equaled our self-worth. Imagine this. A couple of years ago, Elton John went to his bank and asked for a $4 million loan to pay off his credit card debt, because his monthly credit card bill was $400,000 a month. A friend of mine said, you know what? We're all broke, just on a different level. We're all broke, but just on a different level. So when we talk about materialism, that's what I want us to think. We buy things we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't even like. Now, you know, when they talk about drug addictions, they say that marijuana is the gateway drug. Well, there's an emotion that's a gateway emotion into materialism, and it's the emotion or the desire that the Bible calls coveting. If you look at your outline, point number three, it says coveting is the gateway to materialism. And underneath it is a verse that comes out of Exodus, and Moses writes, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his manservant, or his maidservant, or his ox, or his donkey, or his Mercedes, or his BMW, or anything else that belongs to your neighbor." We don't use the word coveting in our language very often. We use the word comparison a lot. But what is it about our neighbor that we really desire? I saw a quote from a book, and the title of the book is fascinating, I think. The title of the book is The Day America Told the Truth, by James Patterson and Peter Kim. And in it, let me just give you one quote in it. The question is, they asked the question, how far are Americans willing to go for money? And they began with the question, what would you do for $10 million? Would you do this for $10 million? And then they said, well, would you do the same thing for $5 million? And then they said, well, would you do the same thing for $2 million? And then they realized that once they got below $2 million, the percentages dropped drastically. But this is what a percentage of Americans said they would do for $2 million. 25% of Americans surveyed would abandon their entire family for $2 million. 23% of Americans would become prostitutes for a week or more for $2 million. 16% would give up American citizenship for $2 million. Of course, they could live abroad for $2 million, I guess, for quite a while. 16% would leave their spouse for $2 million. 10% of people surveyed in America said that they would withhold testimony and let a murderer go free for $2 million. 7% of people surveyed said they would kill a stranger for $2 million. And 3% said they would give their children up for adoption for $2 million. And it's amazing. We still can never get enough of what we really don't need, but that's how far we would go. If you look on your outline, there is a comparison in terms of an epidemic that hit America in 1918. It was the epidemic of influenza. The flu literally killed 548,000 Americans that year in 1918. But I think we have another pandemic that's hitting us in 2008 that's much more dangerous. Instead of influenza, I call it affluenza. Now, if you look it up in the dictionary, affluenza is not a word, but it is the flu of materialism, and there's five symptoms that I think you can take a look at, five things that affluenza bring out in our life. And we find these listed in the wisdom books in the Bible, the warnings about these symptoms. The first symptom is fatigue. Fatigue. Columnist Ellen Goodman writes this. Normal. She says this is normal life. Normal is getting dressed in clothes that you buy for work, driving through traffic in a car that you are still paying for in order to get to a job that you need so that you can pay for the clothes, the car, and the house that you leave empty all day in order to afford to live in it. That's normal. But the writer of Proverbs in Proverbs 23, verse 4 says, don't wear yourself out trying to get rich. Be wise enough to control yourself. How much is enough? How much is enough? Second symptom of affluenza is debt. In Proverbs 22:7, we read, "The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave." Do you know the average American family carries $7,564 in credit card debt? And in every year since 1996, catch this, in every year since 1996, more Americans have filed bankruptcy than have graduated from college. What American dream are we chasing, and we catch it? Is it a dream or a nightmare? The borrower becomes the lender's slave. Third symptom is worry. I love the way Eugene Peterson translates Ecclesiastes 5:12. He says, "Hard and honest work earns a good night's sleep, whether supper is beans or steak. But a rich man's belly gives him insomnia." The reason I love his translation is one study recently revealed that insomnia increases with income. The more we get, the more we stay awake at night. In fact, one study said that the average American spends 80% of his or her time earning money, spending money, and worrying about money. And the other 20%, I guess, we spend tossing and turning, trying to get to sleep. Conflict is the fourth symptom of affluenza. Do you know where your fights and arguments come from? James asked. They come from selfish desires that war within you. Did you know that the number one leading source of arguments and fights for couples and the number one leading cause of divorce has nothing to do with sex, has nothing to do with communication? It's all wrapped around financial tension. It's the number one cause for fights. The number one cause, leading cause for divorce is finances. And then finally, the fifth symptom is dissatisfaction. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. I can never get enough of what I really don't need. Well, I think that kind of sets us up in terms of, I don't know if you look at that and you go, wow, I have several of those symptoms. It is hard to live in our culture and not be impacted by it. We are inundated with commercials selling us things all the time. We are inundated with people in terms of radio, in terms of print ads, in terms of television ads. You know, we are being inundated with producers of ether all day long that says, you'll be happy if you buy this. You'll be satisfied if you get this. This is the promise to the good life. This is the American dream. I think it's more of a nightmare sometimes. Our consumer debt, I hit consumer debt the other day on the internet just to get some information on this. And in 12 one-hundredths of a second, I had 2,320,000 hits under consumer debt. And today, you know, just at the end of last quarter, our consumer debt in America was $2.54 trillion. You know, I really got a kick out of reading one time. We were talking about being taxed, and somebody said, if Thomas Jefferson and Franklin and Benjamin Franklin were upset about taxation without representation, they should see it with representation. He said, I don't understand how come we have to live within a budget so we can pay taxes to a government that can't live within its budget. And yet, it seems like in terms of money, we are completely out of control. So what's the answer? If we're going to escape materialism, if we're going to live life at a higher level, live life as God really desires us to live, what do we have to do? And I want to read you a passage because I think it's the antidote to coveting, the antidote to materialism. And it's found in the book of Philippians, chapter 4, And this passage, I just want you to know, this passage was not written on fancy stationery or letterhead from a hotel. When Paul wrote this letter, he was in a Roman jail, facing possible execution. So he is not a theorist talking about this, but he's a practitioner. And in chapter 4, beginning with verse 10, I just want to read a few verses, and it'll set up the whole aspect in terms of what the antidote is. He says this, "I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you have renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. Yet it was good of you to share in my troubles. Moreover, as you Philippians know, in the early days of your acquaintance with the gospel, when I sent out from Macedonia, not one church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, except for you only. For even when I was in Thessalonica, you sent me aid again and again when I was in need. Not that I'm looking for a gift, but I am looking for what may be credited to your account. I have received full payment, and even more, I am amply supplied now that I have received from Epaphroditus the gift that you sent. They're a fragrant offering, an acceptable sacrifice pleasing to God. And my God will meet your needs according to his glorious riches in Christ Jesus." Now, one of the reasons that we don't face another epidemic of influenza is that we have a vaccine, we have a shot. And I think there's four principles that we can take out of this passage in Philippians. It's kind of like the affluenza shot. This is the antidote, and they're listed there in your outline. The first one is to gain a clear perspective. Look at how Paul says it. I'm not saying this because I am in need. I've learned to be content. Circle the phrase. If you have a pen, circle the phrase, "I've learned to be content." I've learned it. That's good news, because means contentment is a skill we can learn. In fact, he later goes on and says, "Whatever the circumstances, I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want." You know, when I speak on something, I want to go to the experts. And so in terms of learning about proper perspective on money and what's really important in life, I got an opportunity a couple of weeks ago. My sweetheart's with me today, Jody, and her two children, Grace and Sam. Sam is, you can tell, he just enjoys living everywhere he is. And I got a chance to, Sam invited me to the first and second grade performance, A Tribute to Fathers, a week ago last Friday. So this is the experts that I'm talking about, first and second graders. You know what? They understand what it means to be content more than we do. I'm convinced. And in it, I have the program to prove it. In it, this is a tribute to dads. And in it, they have quotes from 40 first and second graders. It turns, "My dad is great because." But you know what? It's interesting, because these children morphed from "My dad is great because" into "I love my dad because." And out of 40 responses, 35 of them never mention anything about what their dads buy them. Only 5 did. 7-1. And of those 5 who mentioned that they love what dad buys them, an Xbox or this or that, you know, they always also add something like, "But my dad takes me kite flying, my dad takes me to the park, my dad does this for me." Let me read some of the responses in terms of getting a great perspective. This is Sam's response. "I love my dad because he takes me to the coolest places. Every time he drops me off at my mom's house, I cry because I miss him so much." Right on cue. "I love my dad because he always listens to me and understands." Or, I love my dad because he always lets me fix stuff. He lets me carry stuff for him and help him. That's a dad, because dads, you know that if you help, let your little kids help you, how much longer it's going to take. That's a dad who really loves his child. My dad is special because he is with me wherever I go. I love my dad because he teaches me about God and Jesus, and because he loves me a lot. My dad is special because he shows me faith by praying. I love my dad because he protects me and loves me with strong love. My dad is special because he cares about me so much. I love this one. Remember, this is a first or a second grader. I love my dad because he holds up my soul when I'm sad. My daddy is special because he loves me so much. The love comes from his touch. He's the greatest dad, in my opinion. He hugs me like a giant teddy bear. His strength grows in me. I love my dad because he helps me with my homework. My dad is special because he teaches me new things. I love my dad because he is always funny, loving, great, and strong. My dad is special because he protects me. Or how about this one? I love my dad because he drives me home from school. I love my dad because he helps me and he shows me how to play baseball. Or this one. I love my dad because he practices catch with me. My dad is special because he pumps the tire on my bike if it's flat. I love my dad because he teaches me a lot of things. My dad is special because he has lots of love in his heart for our family. Or how about this one, Dad? I love my dad because he helps me clean my room. Or this one at the end. I love my dad because he helps me with my homework. My dad is special because he gets me ice cream most of the time, and that's okay with me. Men and moms, our kids won't remember what we bought them, but they remember what we've done for them. Money can't buy us love. Children are the same. They can never get enough of what they really don't need. And we try to make up for loss of time because we didn't spend enough time with our kids, and so we're always buying things for them. That won't replace the time we can spend with them. That's what's important to them. We just heard it from their own mouths, their own writing, in terms of what was special about their dads. We need a new perspective. And that perspective is that we can learn what it means to be content. Contentment does not equal circumstances, and circumstances do not need to be dictate your attitude or your perspective. Remember, Paul is not a theorist on this. Paul is writing from a prison. He understands what he means when he says, I've learned what it means to be content. When he talks about making a choice, he chooses contentment. He's choosing Jesus over everything. Not the Jesus from the Netherlands that we download and we email to 20 other people so that we get some kind of financial blessing. Paul's not very good for the prosperity gospel. It's not a very good advertisement for that. The second part of this antidote is developing absolute dependence in the person of Jesus Christ. Notice that verse in verse 14 of Philippians 4, I can do all things through him who gives me strength. I can do all things through him who gives me strength. Jesus said, you can't serve both God and money. You'll either love the one and hate the other, or you'll hate the one and love the other. Wherever your heart is, there will your treasure be also. I'm going to come back to this in a second. Third part of this antidote, set clear priorities. Remember, he said to the Philippians, it's been 10 years since he founded the church, and he's writing them. And the Philippians were the only church that really helped him when he was in need. They were the only ones who sent him financial aid. But Paul tells them, you know what? You weren't just sending me that aid. You were really giving to God. You know, when you write a check out to Edgewater, you're really giving to God. When you support a missionary or a child on World Vision, you're really giving that check to God. And when you write that check, is that an expense? Is it a sacrifice, or is it an investment? Paul saw this as an investment in terms of our eternity, in terms of setting it aside. Seek first the kingdom of heaven, Jesus said, and everything else will be given unto you. And what does it say in Deuteronomy? It tells us the whole reason for giving, the whole reason, the purpose of tithing. It says the purpose of tithing is to teach you to always put God first. Always put God first. Contentment is not an issue of what we have. Contentment is an issue about who we trust. And then last, enjoy the prize of delayed gratification. Contentment is about delayed gratification. Contentment is about having your favorite candy, and orange is your favorite flavor, and you eat all the other ones and leave all the oranges for last. How much of our life, though, is that we take up all the stuff that we want and we chow down on it right now, or we go out and we buy it right now, and then we realize that it's just fleeting, it's just temporary. Delayed gratification is always better. Paul writes, not that I'm looking for a gift. I'm not asking you to write me another check. I'm not asking you to bring me more money. I'm looking for what may be accredited to your account. And my God will meet all your needs according to his glorious riches in Christ Jesus. You know, these riches are not always financial. His glorious riches, not his financial riches. And I saw the example of this, which comes back to, I can do all things through him who gives me strength. One of the most incredible stories that I've ever witnessed up close. 3 weeks ago tomorrow, I was visiting a friend of mine who lives in Antioch. His name is Mike Burke. Many of you probably know Mike and Lisa. Mike was one of the founding pastors of New Hope Covenant Church in Antioch. And early in that history of the church, they were at a picnic at Stinson Beach, and Mike, as they were leaving the site, Mike leaned over and grabbed the ice chest and picked it up. And when he did, he hurt his back. And recently, he had the 7th of 7 major back surgeries. It has been an unbelievable 14-year period. About a month and a half before Mike was to undergo that surgery, we were having dinner, and Mike was showing me the extent of where his back was now, because as he sat across from me, his back was tilted like this, and he had to move his head this way so that he could stay equal, keep his equilibrium, but his back was at this angle. And as I met with him 3 weeks ago tomorrow, this back surgery was effective. Mike was was sitting straight up and down, and I went, wow. And we were reviewing what he had gone through. He said, here was finally a back surgery that worked, but in that, they noticed another problem, and they had to operate on his gallbladder. And the doctor came in to tell him what happened during the gallbladder surgery, and he said, you know, Mr. Burke, I'm very relieved about everything. Everything's fine. He said, but what I'm really worried about is that you're hepatitis C positive. And the doctor realized Mike's reaction when Mike's eyes got this big. He goes, oh, you didn't know. And there's no way Mike should be hep C positive. But during this surgery, he had donated some blood, or he'd given some of his own blood, but he also had to rely on some blood that was donated in a transfusion because he needed more than the blood that he had set aside. And the doctor said, oh, wow, I don't know what to tell you. And the doctor left, and Mike told me at that moment, he took his headphones from his iPod, and he had all 150 Psalms downloaded, and he listened to all 150 Psalms, or a majority of them. And he said, and I pulled the sheet over my head, and I began to sob from the depth of my gut. I couldn't believe that finally a surgery that works, and now, as Lisa and I were entering the last third of our life, we had so much hope, and he goes, and now I'm told that I'm hep C positive. And I'm going, can I, and they just had their first grandchild, can I hold my grandbaby? What can I do? How does this change our relationship? What are we facing now? And he said, I was overwhelmed. And he says, and I lived with this And he said, Lisa and I had long talks, and he says, and I prayed hard, and here's what he said. This verse, this is the meaning, because Mike is not is a practitioner. He lives this stuff out. I can do all things through him who gives me strength. And he told me, he said, Roger, I finally came to this point grappling with God where I said to him, Jesus, I choose you over anything else. I would choose you no matter what has happened, no matter my back, no matter hepatitis. I would rather have you than to have everything in life, health, wealth, everything, but not and be without you. I choose you over everything else. And I thought, what a great testimony. I left having enough emotional energy to fly for the next year. And then Wednesday night, from 9:30 to midnight, I was back at Mike and Lisa's house. Some of you know this story. The lady that was killed in that horrific accident on the Highway 4 bypass was Lisa Burke, 2 days after I had been with Mike. Delivery truck crossed the lane. We still don't have all the details. Flipped, landed on top of her car, and she was taken immediately. And now I'm back over. Oh, and by the way, I forgot to tell you, the Hep C scare was a false positive. He didn't have it. And now the last third of their life, what they were really looking forward to, their first grandbaby, 4 great kids, and Lisa's taken. And I sat there with him for 2.5 hours as people came and went. And I realized this, I didn't have anything to say. I'm a paid communicator. I was supposed to come up with the right thing to say. I had no words. Ironically, Lisa and their youngest son, James, who just graduated from Azusa Pacific, who starts his master's next fall in transformational leadership. A couple of weeks before, they were in the car and they were listening to a Matt and Beth Redmond song called Blessed Be Your Name. And James remarked to his mom what a great song that was. And Lisa said, you know, James, if something ever happened to your dad, because I love him so much, if something ever happened to him, I would hope that I would be able to say from the depth of my being, Blessed be your name, O Lord, blessed be your name. And now here Lisa is taken away and Mike is there. And the very first song that we sang at her memorial was that song, Blessed Be Your Name. And I want to end with it in terms of what it says. Because, you know, we can never get enough of what we really don't need. But what we really need is the Master's touch. What we really need is the Christ in us. Because we can do all things through Him who gives us strength. All this other stuff, all this stuff that says it's going to give us contentment, all this other stuff that says it's going to be satisfying, all this other stuff that says it's going to be meaningful, it's just stuff. But when it really comes down to it, what we need is the Master's touch. What we need is the Christ in us. And this is how it says. Close your eyes and just listen to these words, please. Blessed be your name in the land that is plentiful, where the streams of abundance flow. Blessed be your name. That's easy. Blessed be your name when I'm found in the desert place, when I walk in the wilderness. Blessed be your name. Every blessing you pour out, I turn back to praise. When the darkness closes in, Lord, still I will say. Blessed be your name when the sun's shining down on me, when the world's all that it should be. Blessed be your name. And blessed be your name on the road marked with suffering, where there's pain in the offering. Blessed be your name. Every blessing you pour out, I turn back to praise. When the darkness closes in, Lord, still I will say, blessed be the name of the Lord. You give and take away. You give and take away. Still my heart will choose to say, Lord, blessed be your name. You give and take away. You give and take away. Still my heart will choose to say. What does your heart choose to say? How much is enough? We can never get enough of what we really don't need. But our God will meet all of our needs according to his glorious riches, because he'll meet our needs in the person of Jesus Christ if we trust him. Amen.